come on in and spend some time with the film hobbyist. My name is Lydia, and I love movies. We're sitting here in my attic room. Behind me is my desk, covered in stray papers, reference texts, and an ever-increasing inventory of crocheted keychains. This is where I work, revising my novel, crocheting as a craftsperson. I recognize that this is non-traditional work, making art and also not really making any money. I spent most of my day as a full-time caregiver for my kids. It's also unpaid work, but it definitely contributes economically to my household. I save us tens of thousands of dollars every year. Childcare is not cheap. But I did used to participate in the traditional workforce. I spent a couple of years in food service as the literal breadwinner for my household. My husband's assistantship in grad school covered the rent and utilities, but it was my paycheck that paid for the groceries. There was much to enjoy about the work, but the constant abuse from customers and the impact of such a stressful environment took its toll. I left shortly after my husband got a job in the corporate sphere as a software developer. And so today I'd like to talk about Mike Judge's 1999 film Office Space. It's part of a bizarre niche genre, 1999 films about white men having an existential crisis because of how stable and boring their lives are. But while Fight Club became drastically misunderstood by the demographic it was critiquing, American Beauty has the awful baggage of its star, and The Matrix's virtual reality of 1999 becomes more and more attractive, the satire of Office Space is still biting and relevant, even as much of corporate culture and the job landscape has changed. Mike Judge is a figure who has a lot of experience in the sitcom genre as the creator and writer of Beavis and Butthead, King of the Hill, and Silicon Valley, all satirical works that dip into absurdity. Office Space is not unlike this. It has a plot, but it's almost more like a collection of episodes. Sometimes plot threads and characters are dropped. Other times the story logic is nonsensical, but here's the best way I can describe it. Peter Gibbons works at Initech, a software engineering company working to update software so that it accommodates for the new millennium. Mind-numbing work, though obviously important, as this was the idea that caused the Y2K panic. Peter hates his job, sitting in traffic to go sit in his cage of a cubicle, getting badgered by several micromanaging bosses, including the iconic Bill Lumberg, who want him to fill out the nonsensical TPS reports instead of doing actual work, which he doesn't even enjoy. He feels so awful about his life that he's convinced to go see a hypnotherapist who hypnotizes him into imagining his worries away before promptly dying of a heart attack. In this new Zen state, Peter decides to not go to work. And then he decides to go in, but only do what he wants to, playing Tetris, gutting a fish, dismantling his cubicle. His company has hired two efficiency experts to cut the extraneous workforce, and they like Peter's perspective so much that they offer him a promotion. They unfortunately also lay off his office buddies, Samir and Michael Bolton, not the singer. Michael long ago wrote a program that would siphon off the fractions of pennies from the company's paychecks into a bank account, and decides to use it with the other guy's help. Unfortunately, his code has a bug and steals far more money than they anticipate. Peter decides to take responsibility and leaves a confession along with the stolen money under the door of the office. Another employee, the easily ignorable, weirdly annoying Milton, whose treatment by the company gets more and more ridiculous over the course of the film, finds the money and takes it for himself, burning the building down. Now without a job, Peter decides to change careers and work in construction instead. This film wasn't a huge hit at the box office, but it resonated very deeply with Gen Xers, the generation it portrays, trying to work their office jobs while hating them, staring at their future in the corporate sphere and realizing how very bleak it actually is. And in that light, I think it's worth looking at what has changed in the nearly 27 years since this film's release, and what has become even more relevant since. And to do that, I need to talk about generational cohorts. Now, obviously, the idea of labeling generational cohorts is a little silly and arbitrary. Is life really that different for people born in 1980 versus 1981? And on one level, no. But labeled generational cohorts are a valuable tool for talking about shifting ideas over time. And those demarcating years are sometimes random and sometimes not. Take the Silent Generation, the cohort born from 1928 to 1945. 1945 is a notable year. Obviously, there is going to be a difference for kids born under the shadow and stress of World War II and those born in a post-World War II world. But while 1928 is before the economic hardship of the Great Depression, it does ensure that all members of the so-called greatest generation before it became adults by the end of World War II, while all members of the Silent Generation were children during the war. And that does something to you. Having your first experiences, or your first memories, or your childhood innocence happen in a time of turmoil, rather than the time of economic growth that followed World War II. And it does something to you as well to experience that economic growth as a young adult. This generation hit adulthood before the tumultuous change of the mid-1960s. And while some of the most influential voices and figures of that change, including Muhammad Ali, Bob Dylan, and Martin Luther King Jr., were part of this cohort, generally, the Silent Generation quietly worked for stability and upholding the status quo. Honestly, can you blame them? They remembered what it was like to not have enough and got to a point where they were economically comfortable. It makes sense they wouldn't really want to blow it up, which is where the name the Silent Generation comes from. And I can't help but think of Office Space's Tom Smikowski, a co-worker of Peter's, who is terribly anxious about being laid off, and who is, actually, almost in a self-fulfilling prophecy. While his actor, Richard Riley, is technically an older boomer, born 1948, his character definitely feels older than that. Close enough to retirement that the idea of starting a new career is a fate worse than death. He's also adamant that it would be best to have a good business idea, particularly if it's a gimmick that will earn millions of dollars without doing any work. And his happy ending is receiving a substantial insurance payment after being T-boned by a drunk driver. He no longer has a job, and he's in a wheelchair with a halo bolted to his head, but he's financially stable, so who cares? Peter's boss, Bill Lumberg, is a baby boomer. This cohort was born in the economic prosperity following World War II. The end date for this cohort is 1964, which I've always thought was a weird year to end this. It isn't because the boom ended. That coincided in 1960 with the introduction of the birth control pill. It might be because of the ramping up of military activity in Vietnam, but that would be a better argument for having it end in 1963, where JFK's assassination could serve as the end of an era, which it very much was. But that's my opinion. The point is that baby boomers were born in a literal baby boom, where things weren't actually that great, but everyone was trying really hard to pretend they were. Baby boomers were the ones drafted to fight in Vietnam. And when you grow up in a stable world and suddenly have to face the specter of death for a war that wasn't really accomplishing much of anything, it makes sense you would rankle against that. The older members of the cohort protested or had to struggle with the consequences of the war, which meant entering adulthood with a level of unfairness, either because you didn't think you should have to fight, or you did go and struggled with the unfairness of coming home to a disgruntled country, or you assumed your adulthood would include that terrible unfairness. And then out of that unfairness, the whole of institutions comes crumbling down in a post-Watergate world. And with no institutions, individual autonomy becomes the way forward. What can you make of yourself? What can you build? Which frankly explains the 1980s. Lumberg dresses like a knockoff version of Michael Douglas's Gordon Gekko from the 1987 film Wall Street, with his slicked back hair, two-toned shirts, and suspenders, unnecessary as he is also wearing a belt. On one level, he's similar to a number of idiot bosses who show up in media. He's not really doing anything that unique, but his skeezy, entitled narcissism is very iconic as he wields his power over his employees with an, yeah, or a, what's happening? And now we get to the Gen X of it all. This is the cohort born from 1965 to 1980, the last year before Reagan changed the world. Also the year the divorce rate peaked. They were the first generation born after the pill. Roe v. Wade happened in this stretch of time, as did the women's liberation movement, as did the increase of women in the traditional workforce. These kids are famous for raising themselves. One author called them the Wolfpack Generation. Parents weren't around, so they processed their problems and needs in a group. This cohort is famous for its cynicism, its distrust of authority, its distrust of institutions, and objective truth. They hit adulthood in the 80s and 90s in the midst of several workplace shifts. First, a combination of global events, national turmoil, and breakthroughs in technology throughout the 1970s had moved the U.S. from being a manufacturing economy to a service-based one. Most U.S. factories closed, some as their companies folded, others merely moving overseas. Second, the rise in corporatization during the 1980s and into the 90s meant a lot more white-collar jobs. This is obviously a gross oversimplification, but the long and short of it is that far more Gen X kids were expected to move out of more physically demanding jobs into desk jobs and service jobs. There were good things here, but it was difficult. Probably Peter Gibbons never should have ended up in software development to begin with. He enjoys being outside, spending one of his days not working by going fishing, and his job at Inatech is neither physically nor intellectually stimulating. But it's what he's supposed to do. Get a good job. Make a good paycheck. Maybe get married, build a life, and I bet that expectation of conformity was a little weird. Baby boomers generally grew up in a time of high societal conformity. So when they hit adulthood, they rebelled, throwing off traditions and norms, only to find themselves back there in the 80s. Gen Xers were raised with much less stability. Their parents weren't around as much, or didn't expect them to be. And so it must have been odd to hit adulthood and suddenly be expected to embrace conventional cultural norms. Some did, like Samir and Michael Bolton in this film, who just wanted to not make too much of a fuss, especially in the plot when the computer program goes wrong. By the way, the three of them solving their problems by only consulting each other, not looping in Thomas Makowski, is very Wolfpack of them. Some Gen Xers resonated with this film by making choices similar to Peter. Changing careers, getting out of the predicted career path. Others stayed in, but liked to imagine that maybe someday they could be like Peter, and that swagger also pervaded their life and work. I'm a millennial, the generation born from 1981 to 1996. The name and original end date, 2000, were meant to capture our identity as the first generation to hit adulthood in the new millennium. Then 9/11 happened, completely altering the global and national landscape. An end date of 1996 means our youngest members could have memories of 9/11. That rupture in normalcy is important. For many of us, it was the first time that we learned the world was a dark and dangerous place, and what evil and suffering looked like. Our first members entered adulthood in 1999 and are also probably part of the reason for Office Space's cult classic status. It did really find an audience among college students who were fans of Mike Judge's sitcoms as kids. But for most members of the cohort, the Great Recession hit at a point to cripple our entry into adulthood. For some, it was the event they barely survived as younger and therefore cheaper employees at a job, which let them buy a starter home after someone else was evicted. But for most, it drastically delayed and stalled our careers. I graduated from college when the recession was technically over, but now that companies were rehiring, they were doing so with the option of picking more experienced employees. Thus, my husband kept encountering job applications for entry-level positions asking for 5 years of experience. It took him nearly a year to find a job. The corporate software development world had changed since 1999. I can see what Peter Gibbons' life would look like now if he had accepted the promotion instead of switching careers. First, his casual dress during his days of coming to work and not working is now the software development standard. If Bill Lumberg was cosplaying Gordon Gekko, a lot of Gen X bosses are cosplaying Peter Gibbons, coming to work in Hawaiian shirts and t-shirts. Next, he would have removed all the cubicles, letting everybody get to watch the wind blow in the trees outside, inventing the open floor plan office. After that, he would get rid of TPS reports. No more forms with covers to fill out. And finally, he would let people take off whatever time they needed, just as long as the actual work got done. But as much as he would change the office, it would stay the same. Many software developers wouldn't mind coming to the office in sweatpants. Having to wear polos or open button-downs isn't as comfy as all that. Next, the open floor plan office is just a panopticon. Peter got to play Tetris because Lumberg couldn't see his screen. In an open floor plan, your boss can walk around and see if you're being productive or slacking off at work. And that really just allows them to micromanage you more. Software engineers don't have to fill out silly reports anymore. They just have to attend meetings and respond to all their emails and work messages. And boy, does that make actual work difficult. My husband has been through several seasons where the work on his plate couldn't get done because of the sheer amount of meetings to attend and messages to write. And of course, the emails never stop. Your boss might not make you come in on a Saturday, but he will send you emails after work expecting you to respond before work the next day. Finally, unlimited PTO is a great idea that is completely impractical. If there is no guarded amount of PTO, any amount you can take off will be held against you as slacking off. And all of this put millennials in the same haggard place as Peter Gibbons and his friends. Instead of day drinking at TGIF, my cohort builds side hustles. I'm not the only millennial dabbling in the arts, even though it isn't my actual full-time job. In that way, we're a weird reverse of Thomas Mikowski, choosing to pursue our gimmick now rather than waiting until we retire. Of course, we're not the youngest members of the office anymore. That would be Gen Z. This is the cohort born between 1997 and 2012. Personally, I think that date should be shifted to 2015 so the demarcation between Gen Z and Gen Alpha would be the memory of the COVID shutdown, but I'm just a film hobbyist, not a sociologist. Gen Z is known for being internet fluent, always having access to the information pipeline, never knowing life without it. And that global connectivity has influenced how Gen Z builds community and understands the world, for better and worse. This generation is entering adulthood in a very difficult time, speedrunning all the crises of the 20th century in a decade. And while that chaos hit millennials just as we were getting to our feet, it's the chaos that defines Gen Z's normal. So Gen Z highly identifies with this film as well. Whether that's because they are quiet quitting by not answering emails outside of work hours, or because they do not dream of labor, the idea of Peter just deciding to collect his paycheck without doing a smidge of work feels pretty cathartic. And it's their Peter Gibbons cosplaying bosses who complain about the young people not wanting to do any work. I suppose that's the universality of a film like Office Space. Generational cohorts are real, in that the impact of a specific time does influence perspective and worldview and cultural normalcy. And yet, it's not an uncommon thing to struggle with adulthood, to squirm under the weight of what middle-aged, established workforce assumes is normal. In that sense, I'm certain that millennials have their own pop culture figures that we cosplay at work, our aspiration for what a good worker should be. And I'm certain that when my kids enter the workforce, their Gen Z bosses will also have faults and foibles to push against. So let's be kind to one another. Let's listen and see if maybe these cohorts don't need to mean conflict, but understanding, which may be the most millennial thing I could possibly say. Thanks for coming. Thank you.